When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 141, where later on we'll have Gwen Berniet on the show talking about a new documentary that she's put together with her business partner, and it's called Chocolate of Peace. And of course, this is going to be a hard-hitting interview talking about some realities justified and quite uncomfortable for what is going on in Colombia, and in some circumstances is continuing in Colombia. So we'll have her on talking about that. But I also wanted to remind you that this is a big thank you to those of you out there who listen to the podcast, because it's due to you that we've climbed steadily up the charts in the world and international charts on Stitcher. And this week we broke the top 10. We came in at number nine. I'm absolutely thrilled. And that is down to you. It's down to the listeners. It's down to you guys spreading the good word and, you know, telling people that we have a product that is worth listening to, worth downloading, and worth following. So for those of you who are involved and subscribing and so on, thank you so much. I also wanted just to highlight a little thing, because we'll be talking about the peace dialogues and we'll be talking about what's going on in Colombia today in terms of sort of politics and so on. I just thought I'd go through a few things that I wrote on my blog at richardmccall.com regarding the peace dialogues with the FARC, because I think in a lot of circumstances these things are overlooked, and our government, the government of President Juan Manuel Santos, is so appallingly bad at getting the message out there to the people that the opposition can leap on absolutely anything and take advantage of it. So I just wanted to run through a couple of things regarding these peace talks. First and foremost, a peace agreement with the FARC is not a rampant pathway to impunity. Legitimizing the peace process does not mean that I am in favor. It's about moving forwards. Those of us in the cities see the conflict as external to our reality, but it's not. We are all involved. No one will be completely satisfied with what is agreed in Havana. There is no impartial justice in Colombia. Do we think that the Colombian state represents the interests of the Colombian people? There are crimes committed in this conflict that are neither pardonable nor amnestiable. Are you wary of transitional justice? But what's the alternative? Do you want the killing to continue? Colombia requires a complete cultural overhaul to be able to get to the very origins of the realities here. And radical outbursts on either side of the political spectrum are dangerous and wrong at such a time where everything is so delicately balanced. So I'll leave you with those thoughts here in the intro of, to this show, episode 141, and we'll be right back with Gwen Berniet talking about Chocolate of Peace, and we'll be talking about this, and it's a story which provides hope for the future for Columbia. So again, thank you for those who have been continual listeners, and I hope will continue to be so. My name is Richard McColl. This is Columbia Calling, and we'll be right back. Thank you. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McColl. Episode 141. Can you imagine? 141 episodes. And we're here, just a stone's throw from the Universidad Nacional, a hotbed of academic thought and intellectual diatribe, let's say. As some of you will know, we're just a stone's throw in a nice little cafe, so that's why we've got the ambient noise around us. And we're here with Gwen Berniet. Gwen has been on the show before. I think some of you might remember. Many, many moons ago, we were on with Andre Gomez Suarez, Gwen Berniet, talking about the peace dialogues and the agenda of the peace dialogues between the Colombian government and the FARC guerrillas. But today, we're going to be talking about Gwen's documentary, which she made with Pablo Mejia Trujillo, and it's called Chocolate of Peace. So welcome back on the show, Gwen, and thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me, Richard. Lovely to be back on the show.
You're most welcome. It's always nice to have people in clear, crisp English accents. Listen, before I already digress, but tell me about this Chocolate of Peace. Tell me about what it is you've been doing.
Chocolate of Peace is a documentary film that we're just in the process of releasing. It's literally just going through post-production at the moment. So we've been doing a cycle of events in Bogota, and we're going to be taking it to Europe, to London, to Vienna, and to Poland over June and July. And it's about a community in Colombia called the Peace Community of San José de Apartado, who I've been working with for the last 5 years. And they are a community that declared themselves neutral to the armed conflict as a way of protecting themselves and living as civilians and having their normal lives in the context of the war all around them. And they are actually quite famous internationally in human rights circles, but many people don't know that as well as being neutral, they also produce fair trade organic cacao, and they make chocolate. So we've made a film that tells the story of the peace community through the sort of narrative thread of their production of organic cacao. So the cacao is a sort of metaphor for what their project is, but also their sort of building in of an alternative community model and grassroots peace building. And we hope it's a story that's both historical memory, but also inspiring and hopeful.
Okay, very interesting indeed. Now, I've seen the documentary. It's 55 minutes long. It's you know, it's a strong documentary. It certainly deals with some pretty intense moments in contemporary Colombian history, about which we'll go into a bit more. But let's talk about this community. This is a peace community, a comunidad de paz, in a town, or near to a town, called San José de Apartado. Tell us where that is in relation to Colombia as a whole, because I know that some of the listeners out there will be scratching their heads and saying, well, you know, this is, where is this?
If you look at the map of South America,
okay,
you'll see that there is a tiny join where South America meets Central America, which is the kind of little tail that connects North and South. And this is hugely symbolic. It is where North meets South. And this is a region called Urabá. And it's the northwest of Colombia, and it's a region that is very remote. To get to San José de Apartado, you have to fly to Apartado or drive there from Medellín, which takes probably around 8 hours on not very good roads. And from Apartado, you can then take a sort of jeep, which serves as a bus, to San José de Apartado, which is 10 kilometers on unpaved roads. And from there, to get to all the settlements of the farmers of the peace community, who live in 11 different settlements in the two departments of Antioquia and Córdoba, they are anything between 2 hours walking and two 2 days walking on mountain roads. The only way of getting around is by foot with your thighs deep in mud. And Wellington boots are obligatory, or on a mule, which the mules are also incredible because they also go thigh deep in mud.
This is amazing. What I'm imagining now is behind the region of, behind that reason of why these areas in Colombia are just so overlooked. Now I can imagine how far away from everything it is. I've taken that road between Medellin and Apartado, and I've gone up further up to Neco, Clean, and into some of those areas. But this is deep Colombia, let's say. I mean, without being Amazonian, it's deep Colombia, and it's Urabá, as you say. And the listeners out there will know a little bit about the history of Urabá, I think. If you think of banana exploitation, if anyone's read anything about the Chiquita or the United Fruit Company, you'll know about Urabá. So an area that's been sort of renowned for leftist insurgency, quite a lot of ELN, quite a lot of FARC guerrillas, and now obviously that you had this, let's say, incursion, I guess, in the 1990s by paramilitary groups up there, and you were really up there. Okay, now just set the scene. I mean, how did you end up in this place?
Yeah, London to Urabá is not such a quick jump. Well, Richard, I first came to Colombia in 2010 to do a 4-month research project with an NGO called the International Center for Transitional Justice. And I knew nothing about Colombia, absolutely nothing. And I loved it. 4 months doing research on the issue of victims and reparation, but I felt I'd just scratched the surface, so I wanted to carry on learning and I wanted to get to know more of the complexity of the Colombian conflict. And so then I went to work for 2 years with an NGO called Peace Brigades International, which basically does accompaniment to human rights defenders at risk in conflict areas around the world. And they do this by sending teams of international observers to walk alongside people who are threatened and provide a deterrence effect because they represent the eyes of the international community. And they have teams in different places in Colombia, and one of the teams they have is in Urabá, in Apartado, but they travel. So I was there for 2 years, but traveling to various different communities in Urabá, on the Chocó side and also on the Antioquia side. And so that's how I first arrived to the peace community.
Tell me a little bit, sorry. I mean, you're a young lady, blonde, you're up there, you're exotic. I didn't want to put this into appearances or anything, but you are exotic. You're blonde, you're blue-eyed. Did you ever yourself, did you get into trouble? Were you ever threatened by any of these armed actors up there?
I think the thing to understand is that it's a bit different to go as a tourist to one of these places and to go as a representative of an international organization when you're wearing a logo on your chest, which quite clearly marks you out to anyone in the know as an actor that forms part of the conflict in a way, rather than just a random gringa wandering around. Most of the soldiers, because the organization constantly has talks with the army, the police, etc., most of the soldiers and other actors on the ground will be quite aware of who you are. And because the organization's been in the region for ages, I saw horrible things, but I never felt that I was in danger myself. I definitely saw the danger that the human rights defenders who live there are in and the threats that they receive.
On a quick side note, the Peace Brigades are also present in the region of Barranca Bermeja, no? I've seen them there with their vests. Okay, perfect. Well, I'm glad that you were never under threat yourself, but to have seen these incidents in with your own eyes, you know, is something itself as well. You know, to realize what these people are living through, surviving through. And so, you know, you've obviously taken this community very much into your heart, because not only were you an academic, but you continue and have continued to work with them, alongside them, and by making this documentary that in Spanish is called Chocolate de Paz, in English, Chocolate of Peace. Now, and what, you know, what was the inspiration, aside from the obvious, the inspiration for deciding to put together this documentary with Pablo Mejia Trujillo?
It was very interesting, Richard, because when I finished working with Peace Brigades in 2013, I decided to come to Bogota and do a master's degree in anthropology in the National University where we are next to right now, which I finished last year and I now teach there. But the topic of my research was the peace community, because I wanted to carry on working with them, thinking about them, supporting them as an academic, because I'd had an academic background and I wanted to sort of go back there and find a way of understanding what I'd lived through and what I'd seen over the last 2 years in the context of the history, the national history of the conflict. And what I began to realise, I mean, I'd been living, as you rightly put it, in the back end of beyond for 2 years. And then I arrived in Bogota and it was a total culture shock, which is, you know, and you write about it very eloquently with your stereotype articles and things like this. And you know, Bogota is difficult for a Brit to understand. And you know, it's completely different from the jungles.
Yeah.
But what I began to realise was that although I'd been moving in the international community, and I thought the peace community was so famous, most people in Bogota have absolutely not a clue that this exists in their own country. And this is something that I found increasingly in Bogota. People, not because they're bad, but because they don't know, they haven't been told, what are the realities of the conflict that have been lived in the remote regions of their own country. And in a way, those of us who work in the humanitarian sector tend to know more about that than many Colombians. But by the same token, the people who work in the humanitarian sector don't often tend to get to know middle-class, urban, Bogotanos who don't work in human rights, who don't work in international cooperation. And so for us, it was a way of building a bridge between the countryside and the city and bringing the reality of the peace community to Bogota. Now, of course, I wrote my thesis on the peace community, but most people aren't going to read that. But the audiovisual is a very powerful way of connecting with individual stories, with individual human lives, and producing empathy. And I think it's a very key moment, and that, you know, you asked me what was our sort of an incentive. It was recognizing the current historical conjuncture of the peace process and thinking that in order for peace to happen, there needs to be more connect between the city and the countryside, and there needs to be more empathy with the human face of victimization, but also with the human resilience and capacity for creativity and solidarity and love that people who have lived through the conflict have also created. So no longer I poor little victims, but also, wow, look what they've done over there despite great hardship. So that was one of our main incentives, was bridging the gap.
Very interesting indeed. And of course, it's a theme that we come back to again and again in Colombia, those of us who are observers or students of Colombia or just, you know, just enthusiasts. It's that disconnect between the countryside and the city, the urban, the rural. I mean, that's the reality, because, I mean, like we said, you're in the back end of beyond. But while your documentary deals with some, I mean, incredibly heinous and heart-wrenching stories, and we will go into them, I promise, but we've got to keep the listeners on edge. You know, there is hope, isn't it? I mean, that's the underlying theme, and you were hinting at that in that last intervention there, but there is hope. You know, these people are working together. They set up a peace community, you know, rejecting the armed actors in their let's say, environment, in their you know, the area in which they live and work. But it seems such a hard thing to do. You say, listen, we are now neutral in the armed conflict, they say. We are now neutral. We don't want any of you around here. Be you left-wing guerrillas, be you right-wing paramilitaries, be you the armed forces, the government state forces. I mean, how does that work? How does it work?
That's a very good question, actually. So I mentioned that they live in 11 settlements.
Yes.
So these settlements are all demarcated. So they've got wire around them, and they've got signs on them saying, peace community, we reclaim our right to non-involvement in the armed conflict. Because involvement in the conflict can be so simple as guerrilla fighters come to your little farm, there's no one else around for a 2-mile radius, and they say, my men are hungry, give us a chicken. And if you're a farmer without a gun, and this is a man with a gun, well, you're probably going to give them the chicken.
Of course.
But then, you know, the guys go away, but then the army, who was on the other hill, see that you were talking to the guerrilla, so they come down and say to you, "Hey, you, your sympathizers are the guerrilla. Tell us where they've gone, and we're gonna kill you." So you know, it's incredibly difficult for them. So that was how they discovered the way to survive was by grouping together, safety in numbers, but also with visible, making themselves as visible as possible, and they do that. Part of their strategy is with international accompaniment, such as peace brigades, but also other NGOs. And I think it's been achieved by legitimacy created over time by speaking to the armed actors. When the armed actors come into their land, they go to them with all of them, men, women, children, dogs, babies, pigs, mules, and say, "Look, we are a peace community. We don't participate in the conflict. Please leave our land because you're making us a military target."
Now, this peace community that we're talking about in question was founded in 1997. So they've been working on this for some time now. I mean, there's some really weighty stories behind this, and we will get into this further in the next section of this show. But I just want to leave on this point, you know, so when you think about everything that these poor farmers, very, very humble folk, these poor farmers, you know, think about how they live, how they work, how they survive, and what they've been faced with. And one of the quotes that I wrote down, having watched the documentary, is, "Yo prefiero un cementerio en el campo que un asilo en los Estados Unidos o en Europa." So I'll translate that. I would prefer a cemetery, to be in a cemetery in the countryside, than in exile in the United States or Europe. And I think this is something we'll explore in the next section, is this connection that the people have to their land, to this land. So very interesting stuff with Gwen Bernyates. I'm so, I'm happy to have her on the show because it's such an important theme. Just a quick question, what is the website if people want to look it up in the break?
It's chocolateofpeace.com.
Perfect, chocolateofpeace.com.
Also on Facebook, Chocolate de Paz.
Yeah, and Twitter, Facebook, etc. But we'll put them all up on our page as well so that you can find them there. We're going to take a short break. This is episode 141. We'll be right back after this pause. Thank you. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling, episode 141 with Gwen Bernyates. And those of you who have been listening will know that we've been talking about her documentary. It's called Chocolate of Peace. And, you know, it's about the Comunidad de Paz, or the peace community in San José de Apartado, formed in 1997. We're talking about her connection to this, but also, you know, the documentary and what really took place or has taken place, and to some extent, I would imagine, continues to take place in this region of Colombia. We will get a little bit further into the whole issue of the peace accords, the peace dialogues that are going on in Colombia at the moment, but I want to talk a little bit about where we left off, the spiritual connection of the local people to the land, to the ground where they cultivate, where they live, where they've bled, because there's a lot of that sort of, not only metaphor, but it's actual, you know, a description of what happened on that land, you know, where the chocolate, the cacao trees grow, has been, you know, testament to some heinous, heinous activities that have taken place that would really, annihilate or devastate any community anywhere in the world. I mean, these words cannot describe. And there's one sort of personal note that I have. You know, those of you who listen to the show will know that I'm a relatively new father. My son is 13 months old. And there's a moment where an elder of the peace community talks directly to the camera about things that happened and massacres that took place. And I believe that one of the massacres was in, correct me if I'm wrong, in 2005, February 2005. And now this is made, a big reference, of course, is made to it in the documentary. And there's a child of 18 months of age who's basically quartered, I think is the word, you know, dismembered, disemboweled. And as a father, you know, all I can see, even when I was watching the documentary, all I can see is my son in this situation. Like, how could any person do something of this nature to a child, in general, but to some, to an individual who has yet to really learn right from wrong and what is going on in the country? How is this person even, to say the least, guilty of anything? I mean, you know, we talk about children being born and raised in complete innocence, and that's, you know, I know this from being a father, and those of you out there who are parents will I think, you know, perhaps associate with this as well and understand. And it's just, it beggars belief that these things take place. And we know they take place. We know they take place everywhere. But now I'm sitting across the table from someone who's been up there and who has had to listen and accompany these poor people through some of, we hope, are now the darkest hours and darkest moments in their existence, because we hope that there's something positive now for the future. Through this documentary, there is obviously hope. We are going to talk about the future on this, but let's talk a little bit, Gwen, about the paramilitaries and this massacre. And I don't want to go into too much of the real nitty-gritty of it, but why would these armed groups be interested in this area and be so violent towards just a humble, hardworking farm people, you know, who want to just cultivate their crops and get on with life? I mean, that's really the impression you get. They just want to cultivate. These are people of the land. Go, just give us a little bit of a background on that.
Yeah, I think when you're against the facts of a child being caught and having their stomach opened and their innards taken out, which is what happened here, you have to ask why. You have to ask why on two levels. You have to ask why in terms of historical context, but also you have to ask why in terms of how is a human being capable of doing that? How does a country get to a place where this happens? And this is certainly not the only case in Colombia, of this sort of brutality. And so, of course, you ask about the paramilitary context in Urabá, one of the regions of the country where paramilitarism emerged, the army, the state armed civilians and created self-defense groups to protect against the guerrilla. These got massively out of hand, and Urabá was one of the regions where they became incredibly autonomous, incredibly powerful. In the 1990s, they started, together with the army, producing displacements, killing people, but especially people who were associated with left-wing political and social movements. So there was a lot of guerrilla in the area, but certainly not all of the farmers had anything to do with the guerrilla. Some of the farmers had been involved in the Patriotic Union Party, which your listeners may well know was a left-wing opposition party that was absolutely wiped out in the 80s and 90s. So the reasons for persecuting the members of the peace community are so multiple. It's a convergence of factors. It's a military strategic area. There were FARC there before, so there's a lot of counterinsurgency, and terror has been used to obliterate left-wing sympathy. But there's also a lot of economic interests in the region. It's a very rich in natural resources. And also this desire to wipe out people who are speaking out against you, because the peace community does denounce publicly the abuses of the state. And so there's actually a testimony of one of the paramilitaries who was at the killing of the child. And what they say is, you know, we said, oh, we shouldn't kill the children, but the commander, the paramilitary commander, said, those children are going to grow up to be guerrilla fighters, so they need to be killed. And the other information that many people say, that the paramilitary commanders who are now extradited in the USA, is the orders to do that kind of thing came from the army, from the state. It was a very clear counterinsurgency strategy. A scorched earth policy. But I think that the whole point of telling this story is to recognize the brutality, but also to recognize the pressing need for the peace process to put an end to the production of more victims.
It's just, it kind of makes you tremble a little bit. But yes, I think, you, as you say, you've got these testimonies of people saying the orders came from the very top, and there's hardly any doubt of that, really. A little bit of context as well, the Patriotic Union, this leftist group, formed originally out of demobilized FARC members, but then distancing themselves a little bit out of that. It was under the government of Belisario Betancourt. It was an idea of getting them out of the armed conflict and into actual civilian politics. But unfortunately, in the 1990s, 1980s, 1990s, it was a genocide. It was a genocide of these political actors, and including and possibly beyond 5,000 members of this political group were summarily executed.
And they were certainly not just FARC fighters. It was originally a negotiated solution after the peace talks in Betancourt, but many non-FARC fighters joined the political party. And in the peace community, you can clearly see that many of these people, they were nothing to do with FARC, but they were making cooperatives for the production of cocoa. They were doing their own model of local development, and that was the sort of territorial model that was also obliterated. So it wasn't just ex-FARC, it was all kinds of civil society who were wiped out.
Yeah. I mean, just by being, having even a mere affiliation, that was good enough, unfortunately. And now, so what we have is this San Jose de Apartado, the subject of this documentary, it really ends up being a region that's sandwiched between different warring interests in Colombia. And of course, this is not, as Gwen rightly mentioned, this is not unique in Colombia, it's not unique in many parts of the world in internal conflict. But you have guerrillas, you have the state, and you have the paramilitaries. Now, let's just say at one moment, and perhaps aside from the absolutely horrific details of what happened to children, women, and individuals, men and individuals in these massacres, you have one moment where the filming takes a turn, and you actually have an armed actor being filmed secretly. He works it out. He asks for the camera to be turned off. But he's there, you see his weapons, and you see he's not, we don't know what side he's on. We don't know, it's because it's left ambiguous. But at the same time, he's clearly on edge. He's clearly not happy with the camera. He's clearly not happy with the international observers, because you see the members of the peace community there. And the community there are there confronting him. They're saying, we don't want you here. It's a tense moment. It's a tense moment, but it shows what can be done. But again, how much these people have to go through to be able to get to this position of authority. And I want to ask one question of this is that, you've made this documentary, and you and Pablo Mejia Trujillo have made this documentary, but in order to have these people speak out to you, you have had to earn the trust and the complete understanding of these of the community. They really must look to you as someone so that they can trust to get the right message out there.
Well, I hope so. It's certainly been an interesting process working with them. I mean, the trust started institutionally. I arrived there, and there was automatically an institutional trust with peace brigades, and then becoming an anthropologist, that developed. And of course, as an anthropologist, it's been very important to me that they are involved in the sort of editorial eye and the thoughts about what are the elements that for them are important should be represented in the film. For example, for them, one of their really strong elements of their collective identity is the fact that they work together. So they used to, they discovered when they were in the most tense moments of the war in the 1990s, they couldn't leave the town on their own because they'd be killed. So they discovered that they could group together in groups of 50 or 100 people and go and work the land. And that way they could bring cacao back to the land, and that way they could get economic income again. So group work, trabajo comunitario, is really at the heart of the ethics of the peace community. And they really wanted that to come across in the film. So they really found that important. So it was a constant dialogue with them about what to film and I think they're quite happy with the results. I think there are documentary and more sort of reportage films about the peace community, but there's nothing that deals with the cacao and the production.
And I think this is an interesting one because you've taken an editorial line and it's clear this documentary is not meant for a solely academic audience. This is not just going to do the rounds of the people who already know about what has gone on, what is going on in Colombia. You've made it accessible, let's say, in its filmmaking standard to more people out there. And you have mentioned that, in the previous segment about, maybe middle-class Colombia, but I think on an international level, it's also more digestible. I imagine you will be putting it subtitled or into English as well. So where are we going to see this? We do have to ask, because it does need to get out there.
Our first or prior audience was for Colombians, because we think that it's the moment for Colombians as a society to be aware about the need, the pressing need, to put an end to the armed conflict, because many of the people in the cities haven't lived the armed confrontation in the rural areas. It's also a call to attention to sort of understand the complexity of how the peace agreements are going to be implemented in these regions where paramilitaries are still a pressing concern, and there may be a lot of challenges for local authorities and for the government to dismantle or to contribute to the dismantling of these structures in the regions. But it's also an inspiration for Colombians everywhere to think, what does peace mean? Because there are many experts in Colombia, and as a student of Colombia, as an academic yourself, Richard, you will have read many experts on how to interpret the armed conflict and what they call violentólogos.
Yes, right.
But there aren't many experts in peace as a discipline. Peace studies is a relatively new discipline to Colombia, and people all over Colombia, whether they're on the left or the right, the rich or poor, everyone seems to more or less understand the fact that one thing is the signing of the final ceasefire, the final accords in Havana, which is incredibly important to put an end to all of this. But another thing is the work of peace building that is going to have to take place across the whole society over generations. And in order to build peace, you have to think about, what does peace mean, and what are the sort of cultural values that we need to instill in order to prevent future spirals of violence. And this is new for many people, but it's not new for the peace community. They've been living in the midst of war and thinking about it for 19 years. And many grassroots peace building movements, like the peace community, have these sorts of values to do with solidarity, to do with economics, to do with working for your neighbor as you work for yourself, to do with protection in numbers, that could be relevant or inspiring to Colombians in the cities as well. So that's why our first audience was for Colombians in this very important historical moment. But we also think that it speaks to many issues of international interest in a moment in which things are increasingly sort of unsettled, refugee crisis, economic crisis, Donald Trump crisis, Syria crisis, all of these things, and sort of the fall of the illusion of neoliberalism and things like this. These are the sorts of sort of local models that are inspiring to people all over the world, and through food. So we think that the center of this whole thing is food. Now, sharing food with someone in any culture is an intimate act. You can build bridges by sharing food. And I don't know about you, but as a foreigner in Colombia, one of the first things that people ask me is, oh, so where are you from? Ah, England. How do you like Colombia? What local dishes have you tried?
Always,
right? So, and I don't think that's just common to Colombia. I think that happens in other places. Probably not England, because we don't really have local, apart from sort of, your local Indian. But, it's a thing about national identity, but it's also a thing about, it's a thing that brings people together. And so we go back to the chocolate that the community produces as a metaphor for what they create in the midst of great hardships. But that's something that people all over the world could be inspired in, because in general, we don't always think about where our food comes from and what is the sort of the political history behind it. Who has produced it? How are the people producing our food being, suffering at the hands of the inequality that is the product of our economic capitalist system, and how can we as consumers contribute to making different choices about the kind of things that we eat and being more aware of where things come from, but also enjoying the connection of us with the producers by being more aware of what it is that we're eating. So I think, so that was a very roundabout answer to your question, but we're hoping to show it in sort of two areas. One, in terms of sort of festivals, and, you know, we may try and show it in a few sort of traditional cinema film kind of environments, and certainly very open to invitations or suggestions from any listeners on that front. But also we are trying to think about how to turn this film into a resource for teaching people about peace, not just in Colombia, but all over the world. What is peace? What is the kind of society we want to live in? How do our choices of consumerism relate to the world that we are contributing to create? What's the link between development and peace? And these sorts of issues. So I think that we are hoping to get it along those channels as well, not just within the film world, but also within the kind of the peace world, and contributing to thoughts about these sorts of things.
Well, I think there's a definite market for it, having seen it, and I think, you know, I thank you for that. And if, so again, another call for anyone out there who has contacts or any knowledge of potential sort of festivals, peace film festivals, social awareness, development film festivals. I know they exist, but you know, it's a lot of research. But please get in touch. You know, you can through our Facebook page, email, etc. You can get in touch and suggest. And if you know, let's wind this down. We've got about 6 minutes left, but let's wind this down. This interview. What is the overwhelming feeling from this documentary is, aside from, you know, the most dreadful events to have taken place, there is hope. And I was most interested to see this entity about which I know, getting involved in the Chocolate of Peace at Lush, that high street shop that sells all of those scented soaps and sprinkly things and so on and so forth. They buy cacao. They buy cacao from the peace community. That's right. Tell us about how this happened.
Yes, this is an extraordinary example, and this is why I think it's such an interesting film to think also about development and business. And human rights and peace, because Lush Cosmetics is a British-based multinational with over 900 shops in 50 countries, all over Europe, the States, you know, Middle East as well, Dubai, Philippines. As you say, they produce soaps and things like that. They, for the last 4 or 5 years, have been buying up to 100 tons per year from the peace community. Wow. Of cacao beans. This is the unprocessed, yeah, beans. And they take the beans, the cacao, and they process it into cocoa butter. Now, probably your listeners know that cocoa butter generally uses an ingredient that's good for the skin. You don't always associate it with chocolate, but there it is, it's the same basic material. Cocoa butter, and they put it into a bar, like a solid massage bar, they call it the Peace Bar, and they sell it in all of their shops around the world. But they don't just sell it and they buy it at a very good price because it's got fair trade and organic certifications. And they also use strategies of visibilizing the peace community and their human rights situation within their consumers. And so you go into any Lush shop, and I encourage you all to try it. If you live near a Lush shop, go in there and say, do you have anything made with Colombian cocoa butter? And most of the stores have a member of staff who is more or less informed about there is a peace community in Colombia and they're doing something incredible. And that is an incredible contribution from a sort of capitalist model of doing business, but doing it in a way that is a bit more ethical. And the peace community definitely see it as a very positive commercial relationship for other reasons which I won't go into. But it's a very interesting show of how business can be done differently and how business can be used to contribute to the post-conflict in Colombia, for example.
And we'll have to get more involved involved, and I know that there was a congress, a convention recently here of Colombian businesses looking to help. Now, I don't know how that came about, and I don't know how successful it was, but I also want to mention here that, you know, with 900 shops in over 50 countries, most of you out there will live reasonably close to a Lush store. So do take a look and do get involved on that level. There was something that you mentioned earlier on in your larger intervention, let's say, and it's about that the food and the intimacy of sharing food. And there is this wonderful quote from one of the farmers there in the documentary that says, "La paz empieza desde la alimentación." So peace begins from food, and you know, these are those two quotes that I've shared on the show. You know, they are impacting. They are there. They are, and so there is this hope. There is this hope. But although I do know that the community has remained under threat, I do know because it says so in the documentary. But we won't end this on a negative note. This is, I mean, we can only go forwards from here. That something, some entity, some enterprise, as world-renowned as Lush, getting involved is huge. Now, I understand on another level, they are also creating their own chocolate, right? It's chocolate, but it's for hot chocolate, is that right?
It's for hot chocolate. It's okay. Called Choco Paz, and it's a very small thing. You know, we thought, great that Lush is selling it all over the world, but again, in Colombia, these economic relationships need to be built as part of bridging the gap between city and countryside for the post-conflict. So you can buy Choco Paz, a solid hot chocolate, in a couple of shops in Bogota and a restaurant. The details are on our website, Chocolate de Paz, chocolateofpeace.com, as well as the trailer, by the way, which we've just published. And it's 2 minutes long. Great if you can watch it and get a sense visually of who these people are. It's much better to listen to them than to listen to me. and also visually how the cacao is made and how it's produced, because it's something that people who live in the cities, we just don't know. I certainly didn't know how cocoa was produced until I went there as an anthropologist and learned all about it. And great if you can also share that trailer, because the more we can get the word out, the more people watch the film, the more we can send the messages about peace building and reconciliation and buying wisely in order to contribute to a better world that we want to get out. So that would be really great.
Nice on the message closing statement there, Gwen. Thank you. We've been talking to Gwen Bernier. It's been a great interview, this episode 141. Do look out for the documentary. That's Chocolate of Peace, or Chocolate de Paz. The website we've mentioned a couple of times, chocolateofpeace.com. We'll have it on the Facebook page, and we'll start promoting it on Twitter and everything else. But do look it up. And if you're in Bogota, get in touch, and we can tell you, or we can point you in the direction of where to get hold of this Choco Paz. Because, you know, even buying one, let's say, packet, it's a step in the right direction, because we do need to involve ourselves. Because if there is a commercial reason behind why these entities or big international companies will get involved, it's because, you know, the consumer is getting involved, and we have to help. If it's just to help, let's say, a small community, it's one community, and then we can move to the next community, because it's a process, and this is going to take decades in Colombia. I mean, that's the truth of it. But at the same time, there is hope. This is a positive message, and for that I am grateful, because, you know, we do some pretty negative shows here, but it's about telling people stories that aren't reported in the mainstream press. So again, thank you to Gwen Bernier. Thank you as well to Pablo Mejia Trujillo for making the movie, because it's out there. The documentary is out there for all of you to watch. Get in touch if you want anyone else to be interviewed. If you have any suggestions, write us an email. That's columbiacalling@gmail.com. Website columbiacallingradio.com. We're on Twitter or on Facebook. Thank you for listening. We remain in the top 20 of Stitcher's downloadables for international and world shows. So I am incredibly flattered that this continues. We haven't broken the top 10 yet, so share this with everyone you know. I've been Richard McCall. This has been Columbia Calling, and thank you for listening.
Hurry into Menards and save big money. Stock up on water softener salt for softer skin and cleaner clothes. Diamond Crystal is the perfect choice of salt to minimize water softener tank residue. It helps your soaps and detergents clean better while increasing the life of your appliances and plumbing. Save big on Diamond Crystal products at Menards. And don't forget to check out the flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save.